We can't control things that happen in the world that impact people's perception, but we can control the words that come out of our mouth or out of our fingers when we are typing. And so for me, that's the lane that I occupy because it feels like the one where we can actually make a systematic study of what is more and less effective and then make deliberate choices.
Hallo und herzlich willkommen zum Was tun Podcast. Hier sprechen wir mit linken Aktivistinnen und Aktivisten darüber, wie wir nicht nur kämpfen, sondern auch gewinnen können. Wir, das sind Inken und Valentin. Wir diskutieren gerne über politische Strategie und freuen uns jetzt, diese Diskussion mit euch zu teilen. Heute geht es um Messaging. Valentin, was verstehen wir darunter?
Ja, eigentlich geht es um linke Botschaften und darum, was sie erfolgreich macht. Und darüber haben wir mit der amerikanischen Kommunikationsexpertin Anat Schenker-Osorio gesprochen. Ich weiß nicht, wie es euch geht, aber in den letzten Wochen haben Inken und ich auf jeden Fall sehr viel Zeit in den sozialen Medien verbracht und uns die ganzen kleinen Kampagnen-Clips und Tweets und Nachrichten zu den amerikanischen Wahlen reingezogen. Ist auf jeden Fall gerade ein gutes Go-To, wenn man mal Lust hat, ein bisschen zu prokrastinieren. Und das ist ja irgendwie total krass. In den USA hat Campaigning immer nochmal ein ganz anderes Level als in Deutschland. Und ja, da fließen auch irgendwie nochmal ganz andere Ressourcen rein in so die Entwicklung von Kampagnen. Und man kann immer bei den amerikanischen Wahlen so ganz gut sehen, was ist gerade so total state of the art, was sind die neuen Sachen, wenn es um Kampagnenentwicklung geht. Und auch eben, wenn es darum geht, wie man gute Botschaften entwickelt. Genau, deswegen dachten wir, ist es eigentlich ein gutes Thema, worüber wir mal jetzt anlässlich der Wahl in den USA in unserem Podcast auch sprechen können.
Ja, eine Person, die das sehr professionell macht, schon seit vielen, vielen Jahren, ist Anat Schenker-Osorio. Sie wohnt in Kalifornien in den USA, ist aber, glaube ich, wie viele Amerikaner, in viel unterwegs. Und sie entwickelt professionell Narrative für Kampagnen. Sie war zum Beispiel beteiligt bei der Greater Than 4-Kampagne in Minnesota. Das ist eine Kampagne, wo es darum ging, ein positives Bild über die Multiracial Identity, könnte man sagen, von Minnesota zu entwickeln. Als die Republikaner da mit einem Trump-nahen Kandidaten versucht haben, in den Gouverneurswahlen total viel Angst und Hass unter den verschiedenen Bevölkerungsgruppen zu stiften. Und da haben die dann ein Narrativ entwickelt, was gesagt hat, greater than fear, also greater, das war auch eine Anspielung auf Minnesota. Da sprechen wir auch im Podcast noch mehr drüber. Aber die haben dann praktisch eine inklusive Message entwickelt, die dann am Ende sogar von Tim Walz, dem demokratischen Kandidaten damals, aufgenommen wurde, der jetzt, und dann machen wir sozusagen den Full Circle, der jetzt auch der Vizepräsidentschaftskandidat gemeinsam mit im Ticket mit Kamala Harris ist. Genau, außerdem hat sie aber auch international viel beraten, zum Beispiel auch in Australien, in einer Migrationskampagne in Frankreich, die Nouveau Front Populaire, also die neue Volksfront, die jetzt gerade bei den Wahlen so erfolgreich war. Also Anat kommt ganz schön rum und ist ein internationaler Messaging-Star und wir freuen uns sehr, dass wir jetzt sie auch für ein Gespräch mit uns im Podcast gewinnen konnten.
Genau. Im Interview mit Anat sprechen wir über Narrativentwicklung und Message-Testing. Anat entwickelt nämlich nicht nur Botschaften, sondern sie testet sie auch mit Fokusgruppen in Form von Umfragen, Dial-Testing. Und im Interview spricht sie eben auch darüber, wie man seine Botschaften ja mit der anvisierten Zielgruppe gut testet, um sie praktisch auch empirisch abzusichern. Was das genau bedeutet, das erklärt Anat dann im Interview.
Genau, viel davon können wir schon vorab sagen, kann man auch übernehmen oder davon lernen, wenn man selber nicht die Ressourcen hat zu testen. Und darum geht's auch im Interview. Wenn ihr nach dem Interview noch viel mehr von Anat haben wollt, dann können wir schon mal vorab darauf hinweisen, dass sie einen eigenen Podcast hat. Der heißt Words to Win By. Den verlinken wir euch auch in den Shownotes, in dem sie ganz viele von ihren Kampagnen, Best Cases, Learnings auch ausführlicher nochmal vorstellt. Und jetzt wünschen wir euch aber viel Spaß beim Gespräch.
Viel Spaß.
Hi, Anat. It's great to have you on the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
Hi.
Anna, we're very excited to have you because you're such an expert in narrative development and progressive messaging with like decades of experience and knowledge and many, many, many focus groups that you listen to. And so what has brought you into this field in the beginning and kind of what is your mission there? And why do you think that messaging is so key to building power for progressive change?
You know, I was raised in a very, very strong kind of social justice tradition and in a belief that if you're not part of the solution, you're part of the problem. And so I always knew that I was going to do something to try to make the world slightly less shitty, right? Or more ambitiously to try to actually make it better. It depends which day you ask me how I feel that I'm doing on that spectrum or what I'm engaged in. I worked with various progressive organizations. And what happens when you do that is that you find out that most messaging is just sort of sticking a finger up in the wind and saying, oh, we'll call our campaign that, or we'll use that message. That sounds good to me. Through a process of what I like to call me-search in lieu of research, where, you know, you are the, it's an N of one and the one is you, without noticing the fact that you are exactly the opposite of the target audience because you neither need to be persuaded nor mobilized because you are both believing the progressive position and already actually doing something about it. But never mind, sounds good to me. That's what we'll call it. As far as why messaging, I will be the first to tell you that there is no silver bullet and that there are lots of problems that messaging cannot solve. Lots of things are actual policy problems. But as far as why I take this approach and, you know, all God's critters got a place in the choir, it's really important that people do all sorts of things across the spectrum of change making. This just happens to be the lane I've selected. Messaging is the one thing that is actually under our control. So we can't control what the opposition says. We can't control how much money they have. We can't control necessarily how much money we have. We could try, but, you know, some of it is just subject to the whims of the funding we're able to secure. We can't control things that happen in the world that impact people's perception, but we can control the words that come out of our mouth or out of our fingers when we are typing. And so for me, that's the lane that I occupy because it feels like the one where we can actually make a systematic study of what is more and less effective and then make deliberate choices.
Thank you for that insight and to your journey into messaging. Maybe before we delve into the interview more deeply, could you give us maybe a brief, like a summary of the lessons you've learned so far? Even though you said there's no silver bullet, there are still some learnings that you have built up throughout your career. And it would be really interesting if you could share some of them with us.
Sure. So I often tell people when I'll do, you know, longer multi-day workshops that if you can only remember one thing that I've said in all of this time, you can only boil it down to one. That one, I would have it be, say what you're for, say what you're for, say what you're for. And what we find with progressive messaging in many contexts, this isn't like a US problem or a German problem or an Argentine problem or a like this just happens over and over again, is that there's a tendency for our message to sort of be three things. Boy, have I got a problem for you. This is the Titanic. Would you like to buy a ticket? And we're the losing team. We lose a lot. We lost recently, so you should join us. And it turns out that most people don't want a ticket to the Titanic. They know how that story ends. And as far as problems, they're all set. Like that's covered, and they're not really out shopping for new problems. And that confuses us because activists, by which I mean people who are already ideologically progressive and already engaged, someone presents us a new thing to be upset or scared or, you know, whatever, angry about. And we're like, awesome, a new problem. I'm so excited. And that is, you know, to quote terrible American pop psychology, which has been discredited, our love language, right? We're like, problem, awesome, like, I'm on it. But for most people, and I mean people who have progressive policy inclinations, but are not activated. Maybe all they're doing is voting. Maybe they're not even voting unless they live in a context in which it's compulsory, which is few places. their life is overwhelming enough. And so what we find over and over again in testing is that people want to be on the winning team and they want to feel like their energy is going toward something that actually could have a chance of improving their lives. And so when you show them over and over and over again harms and horrors, it feeds their cynicism. And at best, it generates empathy. It makes them think, oh, I should feel sorry for those people. And those people could be people seeking asylum, or it could be people who are struggling with drug addiction, or people who are facing homelessness, or people who are poor in some other way, or people who have, struggles with learning, whatever you're kind of advocating for. When your messaging is some form of, here is this terrible, horrible thing happening to these people, you're engaged in othering. You are making of them a them. And for some people, yes, they will feel sympathy. But for the most part, those are the people who are already on board. Those are the people, like I said, for whom, boy, have I got a problem for you, is their love language. For most other people, even well-meaning people, they're not going to take on the cognitive burden of seeing that again, or, trying to wrestle with that again. So say what you're for is where, instead of having negations like immigrants are not taking our jobs, or Muslims are not terrorists, or addressing climate change is not going to harm our economy, which is kind of our go-to, we instead say what is true. And instead of having negative demands like stop this, end this, don't have this, I hate that, we have positive demands. So that's one big lesson. Another seemingly counterintuitive, but like I said, if you can only remember one thing, it's say what you're for. The second thing, if you have more than 3 seconds, more than 5 seconds, is people do things. And you have to actually call out villains. So another progressive tendency is to speak in this kind of meaningless, passive voice. So wages are declining. Poverty is increasing in the U.S. Children of color experience the least qualified teachers. The gap is growing. Democracy is eroding. That's a way that we have of talking about this unrelenting assault by MAGA Republicans on things like the basic freedom to vote. When we talk in these passive ways, when we essentially tell people, I don't know, shit's happening, it's probably zombies, we make it impossible to believe that we could fix it. Because if a problem isn't caused by people, why are you asking for a person-made solution? So that's kind of the second thing. First one is say what you're for. The next is people do things. And I guess a third, but there are more, but I'll leave it at three because rule of three, that's what we want in our messages, is three examples, not a laundry list, is if you want people to come to your cause, you have to be attractive. And what that means is both be attractive, if you can be physically attractive, like knock yourself out. But what I mean by that is in a sense, like, to take the metaphor of a magnet, you have to actually draw people to you. And all too often, the left is the party or the cohort of miserableism. And most people don't want to be miserable. They want to be happy. And that's not the wildest thing to want to be. And so when we are fighting and in conflict and scolding and like this, and that's not that appealing for people. And to extend the metaphor of the magnet, when you attract people, you have to understand that means that you have a polarity. You are not neutral. You are drawing people to you because you actually have a proposition, not simply an opposition. And that means that you're going to repel some people. That's what magnets do. And you need to actually be comfortable with understanding that if you're going to touch a nerve, then you're going to touch a nerve. And that means that some people are going to feel some kind of way about what you're saying. And rather than seek this kind of milquetoast, moderate, we're not going to offend anyone message, you have to recognize that unless you're attracting people, and therefore that group of people is your choir that actually wants to sing from your songbook, then that also means that the people who vehemently disagree with you are going to be unhappy with you. But that is what you have to do in order to take the majority of folks who are in this conflicted middle space to come along for the ride, rather than to go to some mythical middle where they purportedly are, which research and data show they aren't. The people in this mythical middle are conflicted for a reason. They don't have a fixed ideological position.
That's so interesting. For our listeners, because we're an audio podcast, they can't see you right now, but you're wearing a t-shirt, and I saw the People Move slogan on your t-shirt, and I think I remember it from one of your podcast episodes where you talk about the migration issue and how we should talk about migration. And I remember some bits that reminded me of how you somehow apply your lessons to that area of policy. Could you maybe tell us the story behind this People Move slogan?
Yeah. Glad that I wore the t-shirt. So when we did this giant research project in 2012 around immigration in the United States, the dominant pro-immigrant message, and, you know, to a certain extent, this is still true, is a picture of the Statue of Liberty and America is a nation of immigrants, except for Native people. You know, we all are immigrants for someone else. And it's this attempt to do a bridging by grabbing onto American identity and saying, because this is integral to our identity, you should care about new immigrants. Saw a similar thing in Australia when I did a big research project, moved down there in 2015 to do a few things, but principally this project on changing perceptions of people seeking asylum. And similarly, they had a story that said, you know, we're all boat people, because honestly, even Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Australians were a migratory people before they eventually settled. And so, you know, they have their boat people story. We have our nation of immigrants story. And that's supposed to be the kind of reason why people care about new people coming and feel kind of some sort of connection to them, and from there a desire to have good public policy. Turns out, shocker, that nationalism is not our friend. And bringing top of mind national identity when you're going to ask folks to have a progressive view about immigration actually backfires. And so what we saw, for example, in Australia is that when we would do a split sample experiment where for half the sample, we would give them a forced choice question between a pro and an anti proposition and ask them which feels more true. When we would say that the opposition proposition would be, you know, no one can take care of everyone and we have to mind our own people first. And the pro proposition for half the sample was, as Australians, we must look after people who come seeking asylum. In the second condition, the opposition message stays the same. Otherwise, you're not doing a clean experiment. But the pro side was, as caring people, we need to look after people seeking asylum. So the difference is half the sample here is as Australians, blah, blah, blah. The other half as caring people, blah, blah, blah. No contest. In the as Australians versus the opposition, we lost. In the as caring people versus the opposition, we won. Because when you remind people of their national identity, they don't become more pro-migrant. Because what you've done is you've taken the thing that the target audience and the thing you're trying to convince them about have not in common. In fact, you're taking like the key thing they do not have in common, which is their origin. So when we did this research, what we found in the US in 2012 is that there was almost no immigrating in the immigration debate. So there was stuff about nation of immigrants, there was stuff about borders, there was stuff about, you know, harms and horrors, about rules, about laws, about hardships, but almost nothing about this fundamental concept that people move. When we asked advocates for immigrant rights a very fundamental question in something that we call a cognitive elicitation process, we asked them, how would you describe who an immigrant is to a four-year-old child? Unsurprisingly, all of them said, a person who moves. Because that, in fact, is what an immigrant is. So then we constructed a message that we tested first through qualitative, through focus group research, that went, the same is true today as throughout history. People move. It's hard to move. takes courage to pack up everything and go to a new place. Immigrant Americans move here for the promise of freedom and opportunity in this country. We think that moving is one of the best and hardest things that you can do. America is supposed to be the land of the free and the home of the brave, and that's a good thing, so let's make it that way. That message blew Nation of Immigrants out of the water. Why? Because despite the fact that we are high a nation of immigrants, that phrasing is insulting to Native Americans for reasons I think are obvious. And it's also insulting to a lot of Black Americans because it implies a volition that for many wasn't there. It's not like they up and chose to immigrate. They were forced. They were enslaved. And of course, that's not the entire Black population in the United States. We have, you know, newer arrivals and so on. But it's a lot of it. And so the third reason why Nation of Immigrants falls short is because for most of the target audience, people who are sort of unsure on the fence about immigrants, they are not immigrants. They are born in the United States, which is the majority of our population. So when you talk to people about immigrating, that's not in their own lived experience. They haven't done that. Maybe they've like gone to Canada or to Puerto Vallarta or Cancun on a vacation. But that's about it. So instead, when you talk to them about moving, Americans are an incredibly mobile population. This is one of the ways that we differ from Europeans. Basically, we turn 18 and we're the hell out of Dodge. Like, Americans move a lot. We change states. We change counties. We tend to leave for university, for those of us who go to university. So we know about moving. We know it sucks. We know it's stressful. And we know that you don't do it out of a place of being kind of sad and pathetic and hungry and tired. You do it out of a place of conviction, out of a place of courage, out of a place of determination. And so when you talk about people move, that's where you're not trying to garner sympathy for those people who have done this thing that you don't understand because you wouldn't do it. You're instead garnering empathy because you're talking about a thing you have done. And you're embracing one of the most fundamental American values, which is freedom. To go where you want to go, say what you want to say, and do what you want to do. That is sort of a quintessentially U.S. story. And so suddenly you're helping this conflicted U.S.-born population understand this other population, which they might not have.
It's really vastly interesting. And I think even though the context is very different in Germany because, yeah, just like number of reasons, I think it's still something that we can really learn a lot from. And I just kind of rang in my ear when you were talking, when you said that people always tend to talk about the border or like these kind of humanless things in respect to the whole immigration discourse, that we do that in Germany a lot too. And it's coming from a very intellectual place and not from that kind of also emotional connection place of empathy that you were talking about just right now.
Du hörst den Was tun Podcast. Einmal im Monat produzieren wir unabhängig, werbefrei und für alle unsere Folgen. Damit das auch so bleibt, sind wir auf eure Unterstützung angewiesen. Falls du noch kein Fördermitglied bist, dann kannst du das jetzt mit nur ein paar Klicks und zum Preis von einem Kaffee im Monat ändern. Geh dafür auf die Shownotes und klick auf den Link und schon ab 3 Euro kannst du Was tun und Dissens im Doppelpack unterstützen. Werde jetzt Fördermitglied und dann viel Spaß beim Weiterhören.
I have one last thing, I think, in respect to the lessons that you were not talking about yet, though I think you were saying in your introduction that people only put their finger in the wind to find out what a good message is. And I think kind of what is very, very distinguishable, especially in a German context of your work, is that you actually just test to find out what's really working. So can you just tell maybe the listeners how you do that? And maybe also if there are, because many of our listeners are activists, but they lack the resources to hire a big research institute to find out which of their messages could work, if there are any easy ways maybe to test a narrative that maybe just a small group of activists are developing.
Yeah. So I've alluded to a little bit of the process, and it depends. You know, it varies. Right now, obviously, we're in an electoral campaign here in the United States, and testing and research is very different in that context because we don't have long time horizons to change people's minds about something like, let's say, marriage equality where you're kind of developing and building up a thing over years and years, we have to win an election in November. And like, that's how it is. And, you know, it's much more of a numbers game of identifying precisely who your voters are, which we know because we maintain really, really clear voter files and we know who they are, like down to the person who's turned out for us in the past, who we need to reach. Da, da, da. So that's like a whole kind of its own bucket. When we're talking more about issue research and slightly longer time horizon, trying to get people to change their minds. And when I say change their minds, we teach a course called How to Make Believe. I want to be clear. I mean, both change their minds with respect to their ideological position about something, but also change their minds from not doing anything to doing something, which is also part of changing your mind, the mobilization part. So we will, in bigger projects, do a language analysis where we will look, as I alluded in the immigration example, at what are the dominant metaphors here? What are the dominant frames? What is the range of ways we've tried to make this argument? And we will look around both at activism, at public figures. We'll look at social media when it's relevant, if it's, you know, a topic that's talked about kind of outside of activist circles. We'll look at opposition. We'll look at pop culture. And we'll try to catalog like the entire spectrum of, oh, like there are all these ways you could argue about this, including these ways that like anyone barely ever does, like People Move instead of Nation of Immigrants or other ways of talking about it. So then after we have that kind of you are here dot on the map, we will do these elicitation interviews. And the elicitation interviews, unlike the language analysis, is just with supporters. And what we're doing there is kind of pulling out of them, what are the unconscious ways that you're actually reasoning about this? What metaphors are you relying on and you don't even know it? And that is where, for example, like I said, people are like a person who moves and you're like, oh, it turns out that you never talk about moving, but actually at your core, you know this to be an issue of moving. So then we form hypotheses, which we try out in focus groups, where we both do a bunch of open-ended conversation where we just like listen to people talk about the topic, see if we can get any new ideas for how we could possibly construct a frame or a message, and then test out the messages that we've sort of come up with in the analytics step to see how they go. Then we will do a final testing step that's quantitative. Sometimes we do online dial testing where people are asked a series of questions and then they hear messages. They have to move their slider up when they agree, move it down when they disagree. And we're able to sort of aggregate across 60 seconds how the base feels and see like, ooh, whatever was being said at 18 seconds is like getting people really hot and bothered. Or, you know, conversely, people are really turned off at like 22 seconds. And from there, kind of interpret and bring together the way the different tested messages work to try to like Frankenstein together the strongest one. Then we don't always do dial testing. Sometimes we do something called randomized control trials, which is akin to the way that pharmaceutical or health research happens, where you have a control group that, you know, sees a placebo ad that's about nothing political. And then you have people in different so-called treatment tracks. And group A sees message A, group B sees message B, et cetera. And what you're measuring is their response to whatever you're trying to move. Like, you know, the people in the control don't support a $15 an hour federal minimum wage. And the people in treatment group C are 5% more likely to support it. That means, because the only difference, these are large samples, is the one treatment that you've subjected them to. And so you can say with some degree of confidence that the reason for that is because they were exposed to your piece of content, whether that's an ad or a message or a thing that they read, whatever. So yeah, that's more or less how the testing goes.
Awesome. I think that's very, I mean, this is like an extremely thorough process, which I guess also, I mean, I can only imagine that you also like over time gather a lot of insights from that more generally. But coming again to the just like question, if you're like a small group, do you think there's like a small way of getting out and do some testing?
Yeah, for sure. And this is something that I encounter all the time. You know, most groups aren't doing this. They can't do this. It doesn't happen in most smaller contexts. So this, you know, I think that this is kind of like the exception for how things go, not the rule. So what I say to smaller groups is, first of all, to the extent that you possibly can, be a super informed consumer of other people's research. And I mean both the public polling that will go on in any country, even, you know, countries that have far, far, far fewer resources than Germany in the global south will have public polling. And I tend to work in places that have far few, you know, I just came back from doing a workshop for Central Americans, for example. Like, they are far less resourced in terms of what they're able to test and construct and so on. So first of all, just like actually stay up to date on whatever you can find in order to understand where your population is. Normally, you can't glean a ton from that because they'll just be asking kind of temperature taking questions. They won't actually be experimenting with ways of trying to change people's minds. They'll just be telling you X percent of people support this, X percent of people hate that, X percent of people, you know, are into this or not into that. But sometimes you can get some stuff from it. Partner with universities. People completely and totally ignore the fact that pretty much in every place there are universities. In some places, there are many universities. And those universities have giant social science departments. They have departments of cognitive linguistics. They have departments of cognitive psychology. They have departments of other branches of psychology. And those universities are full of PhD candidates who are absolutely desperate for projects so that they can actually complete their dissertation and get their degree. And oftentimes, you can go to them and say, hey, look, we really want to figure out how to move people in this way on this, on congestion pricing or on like making new bike lanes or on, I'm just making stuff up because it could be anything, on being more welcoming to migrants in the city of Cologne, like whatever. And I'm not guaranteeing you there's going to be a human being at a university near you that's going to want to do that, but like there could be. So that's another thing that people really don't avail themselves of. Other things, you can do small scale research yourself through the strategic use of ads on social media. You can do a decently sized ad buy. I mean, it used to be on Facebook. I guess if you're doing your research among grandparents, you can still use Facebook. But in some of the, you know, in Instagram, I'm not as familiar with research on TikTok. Like, I haven't ventured into that. You can buy YouTube pre-roll where people are forced to have a forced view of an ad for 15 seconds before they're allowed to watch something. And you can buy into those things for fairly small amounts. And if you are smart about it, you can do an A and a B. And then you can have embedded within that ad a thing that you have to click or a link. Or if you're doing it on, let's say, Instagram, you can actually have some sort of reaction question and you can see kind of when you phrase it in way A, what happens versus in way B.
Yeah, let's talk a little bit more topical, maybe. We live in difficult times, as all of us know. The right is on the search and many people are afraid about this. And in Germany, there's like a campaign umbrella being built up somehow, which is always called gegen rechts, so against the right. So people are basically campaigning around this defense framing, one could say maybe, which is talking a lot from a, yeah, let's protect the status quo maybe. And from what you said in the beginning, it seems that this is a little bit the opposite of saying what you're for, but nonetheless, it somehow also mobilizes people that they don't want everything to go to the gutter, or they don't want the right to take away our freedoms or stuff like this. So regarding this common fear about the surge of the right, how can progressives address this without falling into the trap of not saying what they're for?
Yeah, this is something that's very live and present for us in the United States and has been for a while, basically, at least since 2016, when Trump came into power. And, you know, we've sort of been in this space ever since to some degree or another. And it's absolutely undeniable that mobilizing people against, in our case, the anti-MAGA majority, in the case, as we just saw in France, for example, the palpable understanding of what fascism is, and I was honored enough to be able to actually consult for the New Popular Front. And so, like, kind of saw that from the French context, very like up close and personal. And Yeah, I may be touching a nerve with bringing up how palpable their recollection of fascism is, because, you know, it comes from Germany, but I'm guessing I'm not the one to tell you that. You probably knew it before. So you do need to make people understand that there is a threat. And in doing that, you need to make sure that you're hewing to the defiance side of the negative emotion and not the fear side. Because unlike people who are right wing, people whose underlying psychological makeup makes them more either moderate or left wing, we are not motivated by fear. Many of us, I mean, activists are, as I said before, activists are a very strange, like, exclusive breed, and there's not enough of us to, like, make up a thing. But as far as base folks, folks who, again, as I keep saying, agree with us, but, like, aren't doing anything, right? They're living their lives. They're motivated. Fear can trigger a freeze response out of them because they're not trying to, like, be in the line of fire, metaphorically and literally, at least in the United States case, in the line of fire. So what we need to do is make them feel like here's this thing that's coming at them. And if they think we're going to let them be in charge of us, they got another thing coming, right? It's the defiance. And so how do you do that? Call it out, make clear what the threat is, but not just feed this cynicism, feed this fear, feed this, like, well, whatever. I might as well just, like, watch the world end and, like, you know, watch the latest installment of Love Island or, like, whatever's popular over there. I have no idea. And kind of eat myself into a stupor. I may be just telling on myself. This may be just me telling you what I would do. So a palpable example was us here in 2022, where we had a midterm election, and our overarching banner and slogan was protect our freedoms. So what the word protect does, and when we would go into longer messaging, say MAGA Republicans are hell-bent on taking away our freedoms. When we're saying taking away our freedoms, we're activating a psychological concept we know as loss aversion. People do not like the scepter hanging over them of something that they feel that they've got being taken away. They don't like that. So you're activating that loss aversion. You're calling out what the other side is doing, but you're also saying, here's what we're going to do. We're going to protect our freedoms. If they think they can take away our freedoms, they've got another thing coming, not on our watch. And so that's how you kind of be in the both and. Because what we find over and over again is that if you are simply an anti, then what you risk doing is making your opposition seem to people even bigger and more popular and more formidable than it actually is, which isn't to discount. I mean, I live in the United States. How could I possibly discount the threat of this? Like, obviously, it is very real. But one of the things that we know is absolutely vital to fighting a right-wing authoritarian, and we see this through the work of, you know, the resistance to Milosevic. We see this through the work of the resistance to Bolsonaro, Poland last year. We see it. I mean, we see it over and over again, is that the authoritarian dictator, the authoritarian movement relies upon being viewed as a strong man. And I say man intentionally because chances are that's what it is. And this idea that they are the father, they are the authority, they will make order, they will bring, you know, they will make America great again. They will bring us back to some make-believe nostalgic time when the world was right and, you know, men were men and women were women and people of color knew their place and immigrants did what they were supposed to do. And, like, you had your role, you had your place. And, you know, that's especially appealing to people who are feeling what we call status threat. Like, I don't know what the hell I'm supposed to be doing. I don't know who the hell I'm supposed to be. Like, there's all these people that don't look like me, that don't talk like me, that don't, you know, express their gender like I do, that don't live in relationships like I think are right and normal. And so when the strong man is presented as, like, this dangerous, scary, all-consuming, formidable opponent, that does make some people unwilling to stand up to them because they're scared. And thank God, I don't think that Germany has reached that point yet, but you have in your past, like you have a very real experience of the potency. I mean, before your time, to be clear, like I don't think you're that old. I mean, look at your own history and what it means to imbue this strong man with this sense of being the all-powerful force that's going to kind of restore German valor and German honor. What we need to do is to bring these people down to size, to make them buffoons, to make them ridiculous, to make them sort of like, are you freaking kidding me, you little bully twerp? Everybody knows that a bully isn't fighting for some kind of higher noble cause, which is what the strong man would have you believe. They're actually really afraid. Because as much as we need people to understand, yes, this is a threat and you need to do something about it, we also need them to feel the power is in your hands. And the future will be what you decide and what you make of it. So it's basically a message that does both.
Wow. It's really, I was wondering about that freedom messaging, because I think at first it sounds, it kind of seems a little bit counterintuitive to design a message against Republicans around freedom. But as you said it now, it kind of really makes sense. Also, when you were saying, talking about bringing those people down to size, I was just thinking of the weird framing that the Democrats are using right now for Trump. And I think it's really amazing and interesting how that kind of works, which brings us to the next question, because that was designed or like invented, I guess, by Tim Walz, the vice presidential candidate now of the Democratic Party. And I saw, I think, on Twitter that you were also involved with his last campaign in Minnesota to run for governor that was kind of going under the umbrella term or slogan of greater than fear. And I was wondering if you could also talk about that a little bit, because, I mean, it seems like a very powerful slogan. And I would be just very interested to hear if you also think that has some potential now for the presidential election.
Yeah. So in 2018, Tim Walz, who had been a congressperson from a very Republican district in the state of Minnesota, ran for governor and won. And then he was reelected as governor in 2022 because there are 4-year terms in the U.S. We constructed this campaign. And by we, I mean a whole host of extraordinary outside groups. So it wasn't like the official, what we call in the United States, hard side campaign, meaning the candidate himself and like the immediate campaign around him, but what we call instead an independent expenditure, sort of goofy make-believe campaign finance laws, which we barely have, right? Because everything is just pay to play. And that's one of our biggest problems in the States. So this IE, which was labor, community groups, you know, faith-based groups coming together to kind of pool money and come up with a shared slogan that was expressed through posters, through ads, through door-to-door, really, really important. There is no messaging without organizing. That is, you know, if you come up with a message and you don't actually figure out a way to say it over and over and over again, like you have no message. A message that nobody hears is by definition not persuasive. So Minnesota has many sort of peculiar things about its language. In the United States, you know, we are many different countries as much as we are one. And they refer to the rural parts of their state as Greater Minnesota, whereas like everywhere else we would say, oh, that's rural Wisconsin or that's rural California. They say this is Greater Minnesota and these are the cities. The concentration of the right wing strategy of divide in order to conquer, which we've sort of hinted at, which is to construct some other and to say, do you feel shitty about your life? Well, guess what? It's the immigrants. Or guess what? It's the Jews. Or guess what? It's the trans people. Or guess what? Right? Like just fill in the blank and keep kind of constructing this villain. You just kind of slot a different group into that. But it's the same song, just played over and over. So in Minnesota, which is a largely white state, borders Canada, it's up north, there is a sizable and fairly longstanding Somali American population. That is a place where when there was a wave of refugees that came to settle in the United States, I do not know why they sent them to Minnesota, because Minnesota is cold. So I can only imagine what that felt like when folks first arrived. We're talking like car getting stuck in the snow, shoveling, like cold, right? So, you know, as we see with all migrant populations, like new waves of people will go and live where people already live, because that's what people do. You like go to a place where you know other people. So you have this white state with, in the 1990s, a kind of relatively new Black immigrant Muslim population. The trifecta of things that the right wing wants to latch onto to say, you should hate those people. Because, you know, those are the three kind of dimensions of the hate in which they traffic. And you have that concentrated in this population of a state that, like I said, heretofore has been pretty white. You know, there are other populations. There's a Hmong population. There's a Latino population. There are African Americans who have moved up from the Great Migration. I don't mean to say this was like the only people of color, but still a predominantly white state. So when Trump nearly won Minnesota in 2016, he didn't, but he came as close as a Republican had since Ronald Reagan. The right, which was in control at the time of the state Senate and the state assembly, so the upper and lower chamber of the state legislature, they were like, ha ha ha, here we go. We can like do some more, you know, race baiting, anti-immigrant stuff. This is our chance. We shall prevail. And so Tim Walz came into the governorship in this context. Like, and unlike other people and in other places where there was kind of this prevailing quote unquote wisdom, which I think is fundamentally unwise, that the way to deal with this kind of thing is to simply say nothing about it. To have a message that is colorblind economic populism, where you just say things about quote unquote kitchen table issues and you say, you know, we're going to give you better jobs. We're going to give you better childcare. We're going to decrease healthcare costs. Economic issue, economic issue, economic issue, economic issue. What organizers were finding when they would go knock doors is they would come and they would be like, here's our delicious economic proposal for the Democratic candidate. The people at the door would be like, that sounds great. You know what? There was somebody knocking my door 30 minutes ago who said that immigrants are taking our jobs. You can't expect your magically delicious colorblind economic proposal to actually move people in a context in which the right has told them your economic problems are because of those people, or your discomfort is because of those people, or, you know, your church is not going to be allowed to continue operating because, you know, purportedly there's some kind of anti-Christian thing happening, which is, you know, would be hilarious if they weren't trying to claim it. So what organizers saw was that you can't just simply wish that away and be silent about it. Because if you're silent about it, the only message that's coming across is the message of the right. And that is lies, and it's toxic, and it's damaging, and it lures conflicted people in because they're providing an origin story for people's pain. They're telling them this is why things don't seem like you want them. Whereas we are not. We're just like, never mind all that. We're just going to tell you we're going to raise wages. And people are like, well, what will raised wages give me if immigrants take my job? That doesn't work. So we constructed this campaign that we very deliberately called Greater Than Fear as a nod to Greater Minnesota, which is, of course, where these attacks had their most potency, had their most toxicity, because folks, generally speaking, in cities in the United States tend to be more left-leaning, and folks in suburban and rural areas tend to be more right-leaning. And the Greater Than Fear was very much a nod to kind of, here's what they want out of you. And you know what? It's a bunch of bullshit. It's the way that they get us pointing our finger in the wrong direction so that we don't actually see what they're doing is trying to hand corporations the wealth our work creates. And that's actually the source of our pain. So that campaign, which the messaging of which actually Walz eventually adopted, and his closing Get Out the Vote tour was a Greater Than Fear tour, and, you know, which we used across the state, was, you know, at the risk of sounding self-regarding, like, was really effective. We won every campaign at the state level, and the governor, you know, that includes the governor, the attorney general, that includes the races that used our messaging in the state legislature. And then we also had two U.S. Senate seats up that year because there was a special one because of a senator who was taken out. Yeah. So, you know, I think Walz is especially adept at confronting what the right wing is up to because he has had to do it.
Hallo und sorry für die kurze Unterbrechung. Du hörst den Was tun Podcast und heute geht es um die Frage, was linke Botschaften erfolgreich macht. Wenn du Menschen kennst, die diese Frage auch brennend interessiert, dann teil doch jetzt den Link zur Folge mit ihnen über den Messenger deiner Wahl. Und jetzt viel Spaß beim Weiterhören.
I just want to add one thing about the Greater Than Fear story, which is that was my very first podcast episode of the first season of Words to Win By, which is my show. So if folks want to hear from Minnesotans about that, they can.
Yeah, we'll definitely put the link into the show notes to Words to Win By. It's really a great podcast. Also, it has been very inspiring for our own show, although we don't talk about messaging only. And yeah, speaking about American elections, many of us also in Germany are at the moment closely following US politics. And everyone is amazed about how the Kamala campaign has taken off. As communication expert, could you maybe tell us a little bit about how you perceive the campaign and what's most innovative maybe also in that campaign that sticks out for you?
Yeah, I mean, it certainly has been an extraordinary shift in momentum, in feeling and kind of sigh of relief sort of situation, the change at the top of the ticket, and then the kind of, for some people, unexpected selection of Walls. I think initially nobody really thought that he was going to be it. There are other people who are from states that are much larger, that are battleground states, etc. So it's been really exciting. I think that the first thing that I would say is that while it's still too early to see like serious swings from kind of voters who, you know, it's hard for us to understand as political junkies, but most people are not paying any attention. I mean, most people in the US are not paying any attention to the election until like come September at best, October. Like they're still sort of dialed out and not following it that closely. And, you know, you would be shocked in focus groups, the number of people who are like, oh yeah, I've heard something changed, like not even sometimes registering that something occurred. So I say that by way of explaining why we wouldn't expect to see like person changed, people like her better, polling like should be radically different. Also, we have to understand that politics of the United States is largely predicated upon a thing that we call negative partisanship, which is where basically, if you're a Democrat, you're going to vote for a Democrat. You're going to vote for a ham and cheese sandwich, even if you keep kosher, as long as it says D on the sandwich label. And if you're a Republican, you're going to vote for, you know, a kombucha latte frappe, like frou-frou drink. I mean, this comparison isn't working. That's labeled R. What I mean to say is, you're going to retreat to your partisan corner. And that is most of the voting population. So we don't expect to see that change because that's a matter of identity, which is constructed out less of like, I'm a Democrat because I love the Democratic Party. It's constructed out of, I hate those people. So that's what I mean by negative partisanship. But the largest block of voters in the United States are eligible people who do not vote. I'm going to say that again. The group of people who are eligible and do not vote is a larger group of people than either Democrats or Republicans. That is our largest. I will make believe that that's a party. It's not, but that's our largest group. And so what has happened is that when the choir is actually excited to sing from the songbook, which is what has happened, which is where we see this attitude change, this kind of happiness and vibrancy, it is a lot easier to get the congregation excited if the choir wants to sing. And what was happening previously is that the choir was like, ugh, like, yes, I'm going to vote for Biden because I have to vote for Biden because obviously. But they weren't sort of going out and like wearing the t-shirt. They weren't going out and like, you know, dancing to the music. They weren't going. And without that choir, even as expensive as our campaigns are and the amount that we spend on advertising and the amount that we spend on field, ultimately, a message is like a baton that has to be passed from person to person to person. And when your cousin and your high school friend and your kid and your neighbor are like, here's the deal, this is what I'm doing, then that creates what we call social proof, which is this sense that people like me are doing this thing. And that's extraordinarily persuasive. So, you know, the like big effects that we would expect to see of like the polls changed overnight, like, A, that's not going to happen because of partisan identity. But even sort of the sizable swings that are yet to come, and we already see some, like they're on their way because that kind of, you know, the choir has just started singing. We haven't like quite, the congregation's just starting to hear it. I think as far as what is innovative, I mean, I think one of the major things, and this goes back to something that I was saying earlier, if you want people to come to your party, you got to throw a better party. And there is a joy, you know, I mean, like having Nicki Minaj at one of your events, getting Beyonce to give you her song, like those are things that make people happy. It makes them excited. It makes them want to kind of have a front row seat. And looking at the number of people who are willing to stand in like 40 degree, 42, 43 degree heat, like how I converted to Celsius for you, you're welcome. To stand for, you know, 3-4 hours to be able to go to a political rally. We're not talking about a Beyonce concert. Like, there's not, Taylor Swift's not going to sing to you after this wait. So that in and of itself is hugely important. And the way that they've kind of embraced joy, embraced to a certain degree memes and silliness, you can see it in their own social media. They've just become a lot looser. They're doing a lot of like very funny clapbacks at things that Trump is doing and saying, you know, they're making fun of them. They're kind of like reducing them to these schoolyard bullies. And I think that's really great.
Yeah, it's really, I mean, it has even been kind of splashing over here, and we've even gotten some of the excitement and kind of been following it online naturally. As our closing question, we have many activists and people that are engaged in politics listening to our show. And so the last question to you is, if you were to give like a 3-step plan to somebody that would like to develop a compelling narrative for their campaign, what should they do?
I'm not going to tell them that they should like go into a research and testing and whatever plan. I actually don't think that's appropriate for most people, because what you want to do is you want to spend the resources that you have, which I'm assuming are limited, on dissemination. You want to take some sort of very, very educated best guess. So what I would say is that there's an architecture and there's an order to an effective message. And we summarize that as values, villain, vision. So you want your message to open up with a shared value. If it is a campaign about low-wage workers, you want that shared value to be, you know, most of us believe that people who work for a living ought to earn a living. If it's going to be a campaign about climate, you want that opening value to be like, no matter what we look like or where we come from, where we live, we want our kids to breathe clean air and drink clean water. Just a, like, thing that most people, really without exception, would be like, yeah, right. That's just logical. Or in our context, because of how integral freedom is as a value that people in the US believe in, you know, in America, we value our freedoms. We wouldn't use that in Australia, say. Like in Australia, we might construct a message around this concept that they call a fair go, because that's kind of a big part of their discourse and their belief. Even we will construct that opening value differently for a Minnesota campaign than we would for a California campaign, than we would for a New York campaign, because we also have cultural differences even within our own country. So then you want to move second to a villain statement. That villain statement needs to say both what they're doing and why. Again, depending on what your issue is, that's going to sound like, but today, a wealthy and powerful few and the politicians they pay for, or but today, MAGA Republicans, or but today, XYZ group of politicians or XYZ group of billionaires or whatever, want to divide us against each other. They hold down our wages while they refuse to pay taxes and then want us blaming new immigrants so we don't notice they're the source of our hardship. If, again, you're like in this wage campaign. So in that villain sentence, what you want to do is you want to narrate the magic trick that they're engaged in, the fact that they are trying to divide or blame or shame, because that's the look over there that then allows them to like hide the card, by which I mean take the money. Then you close with a vision statement, which is whatever you're asking of people to vote, to protest, to donate to your organization, to come to your rally, to come to your, you know, whatever you're actually doing. And there should be something that you're actually doing, which is where a lot of this all falls apart, that people construct a message out of no theory of change. And the message can only be constructed once you've answered for yourself, what is it I wish people believed? And upon believing that, what do I need them to do? Because you need to be able to end the message by saying, by joining together, by coming to this thing, by signing aboard our petition, whatever, we can make this a place where all of us can not only make a good living, but have a good life. I'm again coming back to the example of the wage campaign. So that's it. Values, villain, vision. Make sure that the message is in service of an actual goal. Otherwise, you're just sort of like talking in the air.
Great. Anna, thank you so much. That was amazing. And yeah, there's a lot to talk about in our outro. Also, something that is to be done is also to listen to Anna's podcast, because there are lots of very interesting examples of how campaigns involve good messaging to win their causes. Yeah. Thanks so much for taking the time, Anna, and hope to catch you sometime somewhere again.
Yes. Yeah. Thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Ja, da sind wir wieder. Nach dem Interview sitzen Inken und ich jetzt noch zusammen und besprechen noch ein bisschen, was jetzt so die wichtigen Takeaways für uns waren aus dem Gespräch mit Anat. Ja, Inken, bei diesem Interview haben wir, glaube ich, sehr viel weniger gesprochen als bei vielen anderen Interviews. Das lag unter anderem daran, dass wir recht wenig Zeit hatten mit Anat. Also es gab einfach diese eine Stunde und wir wollten da einfach so viel mitnehmen, wie irgendwie ging. Genau, aber was sind denn für dich so die wichtigen Punkte, wenn wir das jetzt nochmal so rekapitulieren, dieses Gespräch?
Ja, also ich finde, sie hat super viele Sachen gesagt, weshalb wir jetzt, glaube ich, wirklich nur einige wenige highlighten können. Aber ich fand gerade die Learnings, die sie zu Beginn gesagt haben, halt super wichtig und zentral und gute Merksätze, die man, glaube ich, gut mitnehmen kann. Und der erste davon, vielleicht können wir die nochmal so ein bisschen rekapitulieren, der erste davon war ja Say What You're For. Also in den Fokus zu stellen, wofür man steht oder wofür wir sind. Und ja, das fand ich, das war auch sehr lustig, wie sie das erzählt hat, mit dem, dass sozusagen wie oft losgeht und den Leuten erstmal sagen, dass wir eine ganze Menge Probleme für sie haben und dass es halt stattdessen total wichtig ist, zu sagen, was unsere positive Vision ist und wo wir hinwollen. Und damit halt zu starten und damit die Leute auch einzuladen, mitzumachen, weil einfach die meisten Leute halt sehr, sehr anders funktionieren als Aktivistin. Das fand ich auch einen super interessanten und wichtigen Punkt, dass, sie hat es ja manchmal auch Me-Search genannt, dass die meisten Leute losgehen und dann ihr Messaging daran ausrichten, was sie selber gut finden. Und dabei so ein bisschen vergessen, aber dass die Zielgruppe nicht Leute sind, die schon überzeugt sind und die schon on board sind, sondern dass die Zielgruppe meistens Leute sind, die sich nicht so viel mit Politik beschäftigen und ganz viele andere Dinge in ihrem Leben zu tun haben und dass man mit denen deswegen auch anders kommunizieren muss und dass es da halt total wichtig ist, in den Vordergrund zu stellen, wo wir hinwollen.
Mhm. Man sagt ja auf Deutsch auch, ne? Der Wurm muss dem Fisch schmecken, nicht dem Angler oder so ähnlich. Genau.
Das habe ich nie gehört.
Das heißt, erster Punkt, wir müssen sagen, wofür wir stehen. Der zweite Punkt, den ich noch ergänzen würde, wäre, Anat hat das genannt, people do things. Also Menschen tun Dinge und sie passieren nicht einfach losgelöst, wie so Naturgesetze in der Welt. Und so müssen wir auch kommunizieren. Das heißt, es ist nicht so einfach, dass die Demokratie in Gefahr ist oder die Schere zwischen Arm und Reich immer größer wird, sondern rechte PolitikerInnen im deutschen Kontext, zum Beispiel Björn Höcke, greifen die Demokratie an. Die Politik von Christian Lindner oder beziehungsweise Christian Lindner selbst macht eine Politik, die dazu führt, dass arme Menschen immer ärmer werden und reiche Menschen immer reicher. Das sind so praktisch so Beispiele für dieses aktive Sprechen statt so
ja.
und Passivsprache.
Voll. Und dazu hat sie ja auch noch gesagt, dass nur Probleme, bei denen wir davon ausgehen, dass die Menschen gemacht sind, bei denen glauben wir auch, dass menschengemachte Lösungen dafür in Frage kommen. Da musste ich auch nochmal total an so ganz viel Messaging zu Klima, zur Klimakrise denken, weil man da ja auch oft dazu tendiert zu sagen, die Erde erhitzt sich, es wird immer wärmer und so. Und es halt, ja, man oft nicht sagt, Ölkonzerne oder fossile Konzerne haben Interesse daran, dass der Klimawandel voranschreitet, und stattdessen müssen wir uns für eine Welt einsetzen, in der sich die Erde nicht zu sehr erhitzt und die gerecht für alle bleibt.
Mhm. Ja, mir ist da auch nochmal ein Beispiel in den Sinn gekommen, jetzt recht aktuell von den Grünen, wo die irgendwie auch in der Erfolgskommunikation zum Beispiel sagen, Erfolg, so und so viele Balkonkraftwerke installiert.
Ja,
so,
ja.
Und das ist auch so, da passiert irgendwie gar nicht, da ist kein Mensch drin, der irgendwas tut oder für den irgendwas dann sich zum Besseren wendet, sondern es ist irgendwie so sehr losgelöst und erzeugt dadurch auch nicht so einen Zug.
Voll, voll. Ja, man braucht ja Menschen, mit denen man sich identifizieren kann oder die man scheiße finden kann, aber irgendwie muss man Emotionen dazu entwickeln können. Dazu passt vielleicht auch der dritte Punkt, be attractive. Sie hat das ja so genannt mit throw the better party. Also man soll praktisch die Seite sein, bei der Leute wirklich Lust haben, dabei zu sein, weil sie halt cooler ist oder nach mehr Spaß aussieht. Und da haben wir auch später im Gespräch dann nochmal drüber gesprochen, dass die Demokraten im Präsidentschaftswahlkampf in den USA das halt gerade so phänomenal gut hinkriegen, dass es einfach Freude macht, dazu zu gucken und man diese Fröhlichkeit und auch die Hoffnung irgendwie gerade so total überspringt. Genau, und da hatte sie auch dieses Bild von Magneten. Also man soll die Seite sein, die wirklich Spannung erzeugt.
Mhm.
Anziehung, aber natürlich wird man dabei manche Menschen auch abstoßen.
Mhm. Da versteckt sich so ein bisschen noch ein weiteres Learning drin, nämlich, dass man nicht Botschaften entwickelt, sie hat das genannt, die Milk Toast Messages sind, also eine Art Toastbrot-Botschaften, die irgendwie, ja, niemandem so richtig vor den Kopf stoßen, alle finden sie so ganz okay, aber eben die nicht diese Magnetwirkung haben und dadurch auch kommunikativ nicht so eine Sogwirkung entfalten, sondern sie sagt, man muss halt genau wissen, wen will ich überzeugen und was sind vielleicht auch die Leute, die ich eh nicht überzeugen kann, und die kann ich vielleicht auch sogar abtören, weil dann dreht sich der Diskurs auch stärker um mich. Das fand ich auch noch ganz interessant.
Ja, da hat sie ja auch, das hat sie jetzt in diesem Gespräch nicht gesagt, aber in den Learnings, die auch in dem Guide sind, den wir euch ja auch in den Shownotes verlinken, und da sagt sie auch, man muss die eigene Basis begeistern, die Mitte überzeugen und die Gegner abschrecken sozusagen. Oder abschrecken ist vielleicht zu stark, aber die Gegner dürfen es auch blöd finden. Und das finde ich ist so ein ganz guter Dreischlag auch, mit dem man sich so ein bisschen orientieren kann irgendwie.
Mhm. Last but not least, testen. Du hast es schon angesprochen, Inken. Kein Me-Search, sondern Research. Also immer zu gucken, wem müssen die Botschaften gefallen, wen müssen sie überzeugen und da irgendwie letztendlich auf irgendeine Art und Weise ins Gespräch gehen. Das kann dann halt super professionell sein durch Fokusgruppen, Dial-Testing, Umfragen und so weiter. Das kann aber auch kleinformatiger sein, indem man Haustürgespräche führt, indem man im Familienkreis vielleicht mal Leute identifiziert, auf die das eigentlich zutrifft, diese Charakteristika der Zielgruppe, und wo man einfach mal so ein bisschen Feedback sich holt. Man sagt so, erzähl doch mal was zum Thema Bürgergeld. Wie nimmst du das gerade alles wahr?
Mhm.
Und dann erzählen die Leute von sich Sachen und dann kann man da schon so ein bisschen gucken, okay, in welchen Bedeutungswelten bewegen die sich? Auf was für Frames sprechen die an? Dann kann man einen Vorschlag machen zu einer Botschaft, sagen, was hältst du denn davon?
Ja.
Und das dann so weiterentwickeln.
Ja, voll, voll. Und da hat sie auch einiges noch genannt, was man auch machen kann, wenn man kein großes Budget hat oder kein Research Institute beauftragen kann. Also, dass man natürlich, wie du jetzt schon gesagt hast, auch einfach, man kann auch mal auf die Straße gehen oder Leute befragen zu einem Thema. Man kann aber auch im weiteren Umfeld und im weiteren familiären und bekannten Umfeld mit Leuten einfach sprechen. Man kann aber auch halt Unis fragen. Das fand ich auch eine super spannende Idee, weil gerade jetzt in deutschen Bewegungen sind ja schon sehr viele Bewegungen extrem akademisiert. Viele Leute müssen Hausarbeiten schreiben, Masterarbeiten, Bachelorarbeiten. Genau, sie hat jetzt auch PhD genannt, also auch Leute, die eine Promotion schreiben und so. Und davon suchen immer wieder welche nach Themen. Und es sind auch viele von den Leuten in sozialen Bewegungen in Deutschland aktiv. Und auch einfach diese Möglichkeit zu nutzen, um irgendwie an Daten ranzukommen oder Sachen mal systematisch zu erheben, ist voll hilfreich. Ehrlich gesagt, ich habe das sogar selber mal gemacht, als ich noch bei Ende Gelände Pressearbeit gemacht habe. Habe ich in einer Seminararbeit mal so eine systematische Auswertung vom Diskurs nach einer Aktion gemacht. Und das kann man halt voll gut verpacken, auch in der Seminararbeit. Und dann hat man halt Ergebnisse, die man für die man sonst nicht die Zeit gehabt hätte, die zu erheben und die man dann auch in die Bewegung zurücktragen kann.
Mhm. Ja, dann gehen wir nochmal weiter. Die Basics sind irgendwie nochmal in Erinnerung gerufen.
Yes.
Was waren denn noch so andere Aspekte im Gespräch, die du besonders interessant fandst?
Eine Sache, die ich sehr interessant und wichtig fand, hat sie ganz am Anfang relativ kurz und schnell gesagt. Aber da hat sie nochmal gesagt, dass es halt wirklich auch verschiedene Arten von Narrativentwicklung gibt, je nachdem, was man machen möchte damit. Sie hat das jetzt zum Beispiel gesagt in Bezug auf die demokratischen Wahlen und dass zum Beispiel jetzt in der Wahlkampagne ein Narrativ zu entwickeln, was ganz anderes ist, als wenn man vielleicht was für eine zivilgesellschaftliche Organisation macht und dass es aber halt wirklich auch was ganz anderes ist, wenn man jetzt nur so einen kurzen Zeitraum hat und eigentlich das einzige Ziel der Message ist, zu sagen, ihr müsst jetzt alle wählen gehen, sonst geht die Demokratie unter, als wenn man zum Beispiel einen ganz grundsätzlichen Shift machen möchte, also eine ganz grundsätzliche Veränderung erzeugen möchte in der Art und Weise, wie Menschen über MigrantInnen zum Beispiel denken.
Mhm.
Und dass es da einfach wirklich sehr verschiedene Zielsetzungen gibt. Manche setzen sehr auf der ganz sozusagen fundamentalen Ebene an von Grundüberzeugung darüber, wie die Welt ist oder auch wie bestimmte Bevölkerungsgruppen sind. Und andere setzen halt viel oberflächlicher, das meine ich jetzt gar nicht negativ an, aber setzen auf einer viel oberflächlicheren Ebene an, wollen gar nicht unbedingt diese Grundüberzeugungen verändern, sondern arbeiten erstmal mit dem, was an Überzeugungen da ist, um aber die Leute zu einer bestimmten Handlung zu bewegen. Und das finde ich eine total wichtige Differenzierung, weil man Messaging, also sozusagen nach Narrativentwicklung, auf all diesen Ebenen einsetzen kann und auch benutzen kann und auch muss und soll. Das ist aber, glaube ich, total wichtig ist, sich darüber im Klaren zu sein, was man gerade will.
Ja, wir unterscheiden da ja auch immer zwischen unterschiedlichen Kampagnenarten, ne? Also es gibt die Kampagnen, die sich stärker auf die Werteveränderung ausrichten. Das nennen wir dann meistens Awareness-Raising-Campaign. Im weitesten Sinne, dann gibt es die Kampagnen, die sich wirklich stärker auf kurzfristige Veränderungen beziehen. Da geht es dann um so Entscheidungsbezug, also was passiert morgen in irgendeiner Organisation, in einer Institution an Prozessen, die Gesetzgebung beeinflussen zum Beispiel. Oder es gibt dann Wahlkampagnen, die eben, wie du sagst, ne, sich auch nochmal anders ausrichten. Und man muss immer wissen, wo bewege ich mich da eigentlich gerade. Ne?
Voll.
Gut fand ich auch nochmal, bei Narrativentwicklung kann man ja manchmal so ein bisschen den Eindruck haben, okay, das ist letztendlich so eine Art Werbestrategie und es geht eigentlich nur um die Verpackung. Mhm. Also wie überzeugen wir die Leute am meisten? So ein bisschen propagandistisch, könnte man vielleicht sagen. Und den Aspekt hat es auf jeden Fall. Aber Anat hat halt nochmal sehr stark gemacht, dass sie das einfach schon sehr politisch versteht und dass sie sagt, eine gute Botschaft kann man nicht entwickeln, wenn man keinen guten Inhalt hat.
Mhm.
Also es braucht immer überzeugende Politik, die man dann noch gut verkaufen muss.
Ja.
Und nicht irgendeine Politik, die man dann immer gut verkaufen kann, wenn man das richtige Testing-Verfahren wählt und so. Das fand ich noch eine gute Ergänzung.
Mhm. Ja, da kann ich vielleicht da ganz gut anknüpfen noch mit einem Punkt, den ich noch mitgenommen habe, den ich super wichtig finde, nämlich, dass gutes Messaging einen konkreten guten Inhalt braucht und dass es aber auch daneben auch einfach Menschen braucht. Also sie hat, glaube ich, gesagt, es gibt keinen Messaging ohne Community Work oder Community Organizing und das ist halt, man kann ja einfach nur eine Message oder ein Narrativ entwickeln und dann glauben, es landet irgendwo, sondern man braucht ganz konkret die Leute, die das überzeugt und die so sehr überzeugt, dass sie damit rausgehen wollen und es anderen Leuten erzählen wollen.
Mhm.
Und die sich auch aber in der Community gut auskennen und gleichzeitig fand ich total interessant auch, dass sie in der Narrativentwicklung super viel auch mit den Leuten arbeiten, die die Community-Arbeit machen. Also fragen die dann dazu, wie sie eigentlich über Immigration denken und wie sie es vielleicht einem vierjährigen Kind erzählen würden oder was für Feedback es gibt in den Haustürgesprächen. Ich habe zum Beispiel einen Podcast auch von ihr gehört, das hat sie jetzt nicht im Gespräch erzählt, aber wo es um den Clinton-Wahlkampf ging und die Clinton-Administration hat immer gesagt, hier, wir haben so viele Jobs geschaffen und so. Und dann haben irgendwann die Leute, die Haustürgespräche geführt haben, gesagt, ja, okay, aber die Leute sagen uns, toll, es gibt ganz viele Jobs, aber ich brauche 3 davon, um mich zu finanzieren. Und dieses Feedback immer wieder mit aufzunehmen, was man wirklich nur kriegt, wenn man mit Leuten vor Ort spricht und deren echten lebensweltlichen Erfahrungen halt mitnimmt und das wieder zurück auch in Messaging überführt. Das ist halt, glaube ich, echt einfach unersetzbar. Und das finde ich eine total wichtige Verschränkung, dass es wirklich auch kein Entweder-Oder ist oder so, sondern im Fokus steht eigentlich die Arbeit mit den Menschen vor Ort. Und da dockt man mit den Messages an.
Ja. Ich finde, das ist auch manchmal so ein bisschen eine Gefahr. Das kennen wir auch in Deutschland viel bei den Organisationen, die halt das Budget haben, um so sehr professionell das alles zu entwickeln. Mhm. dass die dann oft eben keine Freiwilligen mehr haben oder ihre Freiwilligen nicht aktivieren.
Ja.
Und dann steht es halt auf irgendeiner Plakatwand oder in irgendwelchen Berliner Fenster in der U-Bahn wird es dann eingeblendet. Und das wird dann aber eigentlich gar nicht so richtig rausgetragen. Es erzeugt nicht Debatte und nimmt niemanden so richtig mit. Deswegen finde ich das auch einen ganz wichtigen Punkt.
Ja, voll. Hast du noch was im Kopf, eigentlich?
Ich fand noch ganz gut diesen Punkt mit, dass man praktisch Empathie und keine Sympathie erzeugen sollte in seinem Messaging. Also letztendlich immer darauf setzen sollte, was die unterschiedlichen Menschen miteinander verbindet. Also beispielsweise Leute, die gegen Armut sind, selbst aber nicht arm sind. Was verbindet die denn lebensweltlich mit Menschen, die arm sind?
Mhm.
Oder Menschen, die flüchten müssen. Was verbindet die denn lebensweltlich mit Menschen, die nicht flüchten müssen? Statt sich immer zu fragen, so, okay, diese Gruppe ist super speziell, wir haben super viel Mitleid mit ihnen und müssen jetzt irgendwie was für sie tun. Da meint Anat ja eben, dass es letztendlich Othering ist und deswegen immer sehr stark begrenzt, weil es so ein bisschen auf das Gutdünken angewiesen ist. Auf dieses Gutmenschentum könnte man vielleicht auch sagen. Wohingegen, wenn man praktisch auf die verbindenden Sachen setzt, es dann für die Leute total klar ist und normal ist, dass sie sich dazu empathisch verhalten.
Mhm. Ja, voll. Das fand ich auch einen total wichtigen, guten Punkt. Vielleicht kommen wir zum Schluss langsam und greifen aber nochmal die letzten drei Punkte auf, die sie gesagt hat, wenn man narrativ entwickeln will. Und das fand ich auch nochmal wichtig, das auch nochmal so einzuschätzen von der Ressourcenseite aus. Natürlich haben die meisten Gruppen, gerade kleinere Gruppen, nicht die Kapazitäten, in eine Narrativentwicklung ultra viel Zeit zu stecken oder das alles irgendwie sozusagen professionell zu testen. Da hat sie aber dann nochmal die drei V's, also die drei V's mit uns auf den Weg gegeben. Und zwar das erste ist Values, also Werte. Wenn man ein Narrativ entwickelt, dann soll man zum gemeinsamen Wert eröffnen. Also sowas wie so ein Glaubenssatz, den alle teilen. Sowas wie...
Den alle teilen, die man erreichen möchte, ne?
Genau, klar. Aber möglichst, also ein möglichst breites Spektrum halt. Und da lohnt es sich aber wirklich, glaube ich, auch dann immer nochmal, gerade in Deutschland gibt es echt viel Forschung auch zu Wertorientierung, auch von den politischen Stiftungen und so, da kann man sich echt gut informieren darüber, auch was in Deutschland für Werte eigentlich wo geteilt werden. Aber da kann man halt natürlich mit sowas öffnen wie, wir wollen alle ein, das hängt jetzt natürlich total vom Thema ab, aber wir wollen alle eine sichere Zukunft oder wir wollen alle für unsere Kinder eine sichere Zukunft schaffen oder so, wenn man jetzt zum Beispiel auch in so eine Klimarichtung denkt oder so.
Ja, der zweite Punkt, die Villains, also die Bösewichte könnte man vielleicht auf Deutsch sagen. Die Leute, die irgendwie eine Gefahr darstellen für das, was wir wollen und das, was wir glauben. Das bedeutet, das sind dann so Leute wie Björn Höcke, die zum Beispiel das alles jetzt einfach nur ignorieren wollen und sich der Realität verweigern wollen, dass es für eine sichere Zukunft zum Beispiel einen Umbau von unseren Industrien braucht. Und dadurch setzt Höcke das Ganze eben total aufs Spiel. Diesen Wert, den wir alle miteinander teilen, dass auch unsere Kinder irgendwie eine gute Zukunft haben sollten.
Genau. Und dann kommt als drittes wie die Vision. Und da kann man es nochmal zusammenfassen. Und das ist eigentlich was, wo sie auch gesagt hat, das ist dann eigentlich auch da ist der Call to Action total wichtig. Und jetzt haben wir natürlich keine Aktion, die alle machen sollen. Aber wir können dann sowas sagen wie, um das zu erreichen und dafür die gesellschaftlichen Mehrheiten zu gewinnen, müssen wir alle am Freitag zum Streik gehen.
Oder man könnte zum Beispiel sagen, aber mit dieser Botschaft erreichen wir noch viel zu wenig Menschen. Und es ist super wichtig, dass mehr Leute davon erfahren, wie man diese Narrative verändern kann. Deswegen solltet ihr diesen Podcast mit euren Verwandten und Freunden teilen und am besten auch noch Fördermitglied werden, weil ohne eine kritische Öffentlichkeit können wir Höcke nichts entgegensetzen. Deswegen geht jetzt auf den Link in den Shownotes und werdet was tun Fördermitglied. Das wäre eine persönliche Theory of Change.
Bisschen eigennützige Theory of Change.
Auch. Ja, aber so vor allem, ich finde dieser Punkt mit Theory of Change, der ist tatsächlich noch ganz wichtig, dass man nicht nur sagt, jetzt mach irgendwas, Call to Action, sondern erklär den Leuten, wie das, was sie machen sollen, einen Unterschied macht im großen Ganzen. Ne?
Ja, total, voll. Und was jetzt noch wichtig ist, ist aber auch die Regel, immer nur einen Call. Weil wenn man mehrere Calls gibt, sind Leute verwirrt und machen meistens am Ende davon gar nichts. Von daher, entweder teilen oder Fördermitglied werden.
Okay, ja.
Okay. Jetzt schweifen wir aus, aber wir hoffen, es hat euch gefallen und ihr konntet viel mitnehmen aus dem Gespräch mit Anat und dass ihr uns gewogen bleibt, bis es wieder heißt.
Was tun?
Tschüss.
Ciao. Das war der Was tun Podcast. Konzept und Redaktion Inken Beermann und Valentin Isen. Schnitt Julian Schlumberger. Und die Musik kommt von Richard Waterman.